Our next speaker is Stuart Buck. Stuart comes to us from the Arnold Ventures, where he's been studying bad science. We did Stuart's book in our book club, Acting White. Stuart, fire away.
Thanks, Larry. So the theme of my talk is this, that despite a lot of bad studies that we've seen in the news lately, science in the era of COVID, or what it might call COVID science, offers a model for improving the quality and innovation of all of science. So let me explain. So the first major point, the typical way we do science is too individualistic, too slow, and too unavailable or closed. So it's too individualistic because from the time you're a doctoral student to the time that you're up for tenure, you're judged on your individual contributions. Are you coming up with publishable results? How high is your stack of publications? How many citations do you personally have? It's also too slow because it can take many months or even years for an article to wind its way through peer review before finally appearing in print. For example, one review of clinical trials found that the time between a trial completion and publication was typically between 1.7 and 3 years. And it's too closed off in that publications are expensive, data sets usually aren't shared, and so forth. Now, the second major point, COVID science is dramatically different. It's more collaborative. As the New York Times puts it, while political leaders have locked their borders, scientists have been shattering theirs, creating a global collaboration unlike any in history. The pace of COVID science is also far more rapid. Studies are appearing in top journals in weeks or even days, rather than after several months or years. Thousands of preprints have been posted online, which refers to articles that have not yet been peer-reviewed. And it's all more open science as well. Journals have agreed to make thousands of their COVID papers freely available to the public and to scientists, and there are worldwide data sharing initiatives so that the COVID data is put to its maximum use. The OECD even put out a report recently, Why Open Science is Critical to Combating COVID-19. The third phenomenon, though, is that there's been some backlash against all this speed and openness. So a typical recent headline, unvetted science is fueling COVID-19 misinformation. Or this headline from the Columbia Journalism Review, covering science at dangerous speeds. And there is a point to this. There have been a lot of bad studies in the news. So here are a few examples. About a week ago, The Economist reported on a paper out of France claiming that, quote, smokers are much less likely to suffer severely from COVID-19, end quote, and speculating that nicotine has a protective effect. Now, if you look at the actual paper, what they did was interview several hundred hospitalized people in France and ask them whether they smoked. 6% said yes. And the authors say that this is much lower than the average smoking rate in all of France. And so, voila, smoking is good for you. Well, interviews are highly questionable in this circumstance. Some patients might deny being smokers because they want to make a good impression. But worse, the data is only on patients who are not in the ICU, because the authors say that ICU patients are too hard to interview. And nor for that matter, I would point out, does the data include dead people? Because it turns out it's very hard to interview dead people. So it means that if a study depends on interviewing people to find out the key data that you're going to rely upon, it's going to underrepresent people who already died and the reasons for their deaths. So for all we know from the study, all of the French smokers were already in the ICU or had already died. So it's irresponsible for The Economist to present this as if it's a reason to start smoking. Here's another example, and this isn't really a study. It's more of a data analysis, but it's kind of fun to make fun of. So in late April, there was a Wall Street Journal op-ed titled, Do Lockdowns Save Many Lives? In most places, the data say no. The main author is TJ Rogers, founder of Cypress Semiconductor, and along with a couple of other entrepreneurs, he did a, quote, simple one-variable correlation of deaths per million and days to shutdown, by which he meant the number of days that it took for a state to issue a lockdown order. So his results were, quote, the correlation coefficient was 5.5%, so low that the engineers I used to employ would have summarized it as no correlation and moved on to find the real cause of the problem, end quote. Now, my problem with this is that just as correlation isn't causation, the lack of correlation isn't the lack of causation. Because after all, a governor of a densely populated state with lots of international travel might correctly see that there's a high risk of COVID-19 and decide to shut down earlier than a state that's mostly rural and sparsely populated. If the first state still sees a higher rate of COVID-19 deaths than the second state, it doesn't mean that shutdowns don't work. In both states, the death rate might have been even higher without a shutdown. So the real question here is how much shutdowns slow the transmission of COVID compared to not shutting down, and whether and how the shutdowns can be safely lifted and to what extent. Those are great questions to be asking, The Wall Street Journal data analysis provides no information about that. So third example is a study out of Stanford claiming that the true fatality rate of COVID is about the same as the flu. Now, the way they got to this conclusion was they tested residents of Santa Clara County for antibodies to COVID, and they found that the infection rate was perhaps 50 times what had been reported. So logically, if that many more people were infected without getting sick or dying, then the risks of COVID are far overestimated. This paper got a huge amount of publicity, and that's indeed because it's studying a question that we need to know. But there were many problems with the study. One is that they recruited people to test by sending around messages and ads that basically said, if you think you had COVID, sign up here to know for sure. So now they're studying a group of people who are not a random sample, but were highly selected for being at risk of COVID or being interested in COVID. And another problem is just sheer implausibility. If you took their calculations seriously, then given the actual number of deaths in New York City, more people would have to be infected than even exist in New York City. So if a study returns impossible results, something went wrong. So a final point to wrap it up, even with all these bad studies in the news, it's not as if normal science is all that great either. At Arnold Ventures, we have funded work on scientific reproducibility, and across many fields, even traditional peer-reviewed science has trouble being replicated. There are many examples of bad science that was peer-reviewed, and that perversely gets reported in the news as if traditional peer review automatically makes science trustworthy. It doesn't. In fact, what we see happening in social media right now is far more aggressive and thorough than traditional peer review in catching mistakes, bad data or analyses and so forth. In real time, you can see the world's top experts in immunology and epidemiology and clinical trials on Twitter analyzing and tearing apart the recent studies. So I'd argue that what we see with COVID science is how all of science ought to work more often. It's more collaborative, open, and innovative, and yet combined with public scrutiny that is more open and critical than traditional peer review. Thanks.
Thank you, Stuart.